Doug Wiltse of the United States Army is my guest, and you can read more about his work at federalnewsradio.com. And Doug, it is great to see you. Thank you very much for coming here, and we will look forward to the online chat coming up and giving folks a chance to submit their questions to you and have you answer those. I read about three priority issues that you've established for your office, and I'd like to talk about each of those in turn and just kind of get an update on where you stand on each of those. You spoke about the concept of uninterrupted capability delivery in a fiscally constrained environment. I think we all get the fiscally constrained environment part of that, given the budget dialogue that we hear on the Hill all the time. Talk about how you go about trying to deliver that uninterrupted capability in an environment such as we're in today. Thank you very much for coming.
So first, thanks for having me. This is a great opportunity. The real focus when you look at uninterrupted capability delivery is really about planning. Money tends to determine velocity for us in some of the areas that we work. And so by planning correctly, we'll be allowed to ensure that we continue to bring the capability based on the amount of money that we have. We can expand our ability to move faster or stay within the constraints that are there. But really, it's about the organization providing the professional solutions on time within the constraints that we have. So we do that in really kind of two ways. So one is to make sure that we're balancing requirements with the amount of money that we have, identifying back to the proponent or the user whether there's a problem there. If there's not sufficient money to get the same level of performance, what can the money provide?
Mm-hmm.
Have that discussion, make some decisions, and then move forward. So continue to bring capability. And if we have to do it incrementally, we can. If we have to do it in one big chunk, then there's a resource problem that we have to go resolve. And so by working and collaborating together with our user community, with the functionals and the proponents, it allows us to try and balance how we're going to do uninterrupted capability delivery within the fiscal constraints that we're in today.
I'm struck by the conversations that I have with folks in the civilian agencies who are talking about what you just described. And I won't say it, they're talking about it as a novelty, but it is a newer concept than I think it is in the defense community, which is very avid collaboration and consultation with the end users of whatever it is that you're trying to put together.
Well, I'd absolutely agree. It's not a new concept. It goes on continuously, and it is the way that allows us to shape the products as they get delivered. As if we're in a situation where what they're asking for, we need more dollars to buy that. And on the other side of that is, what capability can we give you with the dollars that mm-hmm. you have?
I'm sure it's never a happy conversation when you say we can't afford to do that. But is the mindset, is the cultural view changing to understand that, commensurate with the shrinkage of the budget or the impact that we've seen on the budget over the last couple of years, where people get it that we can't do everything that we want to do necessarily?
Yes, it is. In the portfolio that my organization works in, so the Program Executive Office for Enterprise Information Systems is the acquisition organization that provides enterprise level services to the Army, the services and products. The key to that is that it's an enterprise level, and so doing things incrementally, very similar to what the IT world does, is part of the business model. And so that allows us to do that probably easier than someone who's building a tank or building an MRAP or building a combat vehicle. That mm-hmm. would be a little difficult.
The second of your priorities areas is execution excellence. Pretty straightforward description. Mm-hmm. How do you measure that? How do you determine that what you're putting out there in collaboration with your end users is what's really needed to fulfill the mission?
So there's a couple of ways. The first way is the device or is the product or is the service meeting the requirements that and the expectations, because sometimes those are two different things, but meeting the requirements and the expectations that the user community has asked for. That feedback is very quick. As they start to use the device during testing, during prototyping, we get immediate feedback as to whether the performance and is meeting their expectations. The second way, though, that execution excellence is focused on is to ensure that we are doing the proper planning to execute the development and the procurement of whatever device we're supposed to be buying in the year that we're supposed to be doing it. What we've put as a goal is that we'll have all of our contracts awarded by March, which is about halfway through the fiscal year. And the idea is to ensure that we have the planning done properly with our user community so that the requirements are clearly defined early enough, mm-hmm. which is about July of the year before, so that we can go through the contracting process and start delivering product within that year. And by doing that, you can measure your performance. You can measure whether you're executing correctly. If you're not, you can very quickly see why. Is it that we didn't anticipate something that has extended the time? Is there another milestone that has to be achieved before we can award the contract? And those are very simple to define. So mm-hmm. we can measure our performance in how we're executing the money that the Army's given us, because the Army has decided that the capabilities they've asked us to go buy are important. Our job is to go get those. Mm-hmm. And so we're all very focused on making sure we do that in a timely manner. Then go back to the first feedback is once that starts to deliver, what's the user community expectation and what is their evaluation of the system. Mm-hmm. And that'll either be, as I said, that'll either be in early use or in testing, we'll start to see it. Mm-hmm. And then we adjust from there.
I appreciate that distinction between requirements and expectations, because I'm not sure that's a distinction that's always made by the procurers, by the builders, but it certainly is, there's a difference in the end user community.
It's a fascinating thing in our business, in the IT business, because all these young men and women are so technically savvy, mm-hmm. and the front end, the user interface to them is everything. It needs to be very simple. It needs to be very quick and very responsive, and it needs to be very adaptive. And so that community is very quick to feedback. And so although we may deliver a product that I can make it operate and give exactly what you've asked me to do, the expectation is something that how they want to use it is as important as what they're using. The other piece of that is that we try very early on to make sure that we're collaborating together during that development cycle to make sure we're catching those types of needs.
Mm-hmm. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard, and you've probably heard many in the years that you've been in this business too, of deployments that involve some permutation of, well, how come it doesn't do this? And and everybody's saying, well, everybody's just kind of looking at each other.
Right.
And that collaboration is, I guess, the most important way to avoid having that situation when you flip the switch.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doug Wiltsey is my guest, and the third item on your priority issue list is organizational development and shaping. Tell me about the vision behind that concept.
So the idea is that we've got the organization has come through a series of negative events. We had the furlough for all of the civilian employees. There were some pay freezes and some hiring freezes that have gone on. And so part of this is to look at the organization. It's a living organization, so programs will go from development into production and production into sustainment. And the types of people you need in development are not the same types of people you need in sustainment. And so the first question is, are we organized correctly to do the job that we need to do? The second is to build the ability to allow for people inside the organization to compete for jobs as they become open. And it's all about trying to make sure that we do the right things for the employees, get them the proper training, get them the proper experience so that they're competitive at whatever they want to do. Mm-hmm. We've established a mentoring program, a very formal mentoring program across the PEO that allows us to take very experienced senior leaders and match them up with employees that have questions on how do I get to the next level of my job? How do I get to management? How do I get to a supervisory role? And so the mentors will lay those plans out. It's a very powerful tool for us, and it's very helpful in understanding the feedback that we get from the what we call the mentees, the mm-hmm. people that are being mentored. But also feedback as you look across the organization and you look across the people that are involved in the program as to where their questions are, and then be able to try and implement training that will continue to develop it. So that's really about development and shaping.
Of the three priorities, I think that one fascinates me the most, because I wonder if it would be fair to say a decade ago, 15 years ago, the topics that you just laid out would not be receiving priority at the PEO level. There would be an HR person who had that portfolio, and periodically he or she would come to the PEO and say, this is where we are. And the PEO would say, great, thanks for the update. And that would be about the extent of it. And he or she would get back to the supposed business at hand. And I think it's really striking that you're involved in those issues on an ongoing basis. It sounds like you've really got your hands in them, not just watching somebody else maintain that portfolio.
True, although I disagree with you that 10 or 15 years ago it wasn't there. And here's why. One, there's an Army culture. And the Army culture is about making sure that the folks that are working for you are prepared to take your job someday, and to make sure as part of the family that we take care of each other and do the right things to put them in a position to be successful. Mm-hmm. But if I go back 15 years ago, and I was working for the United States Army 15 years ago, there probably wasn't a formal mentoring program, but there was always an informal mentoring program. You always had those two or three people that were one or two levels above you that you could go into the office and say, I'm stuck. Mm-hmm. What do I need to do to go to this thing? Or I want to change the type of job that I do. That process has always been there. And so what we've tried to do is formalize it, because I think the thing I've learned over the last 10 or 15 years is that some organizations probably do it better than other organizations. And so for us, what we tried to do is create a consistent development program across the entire organization.
Mm-hmm. So would it be fair to say that in addition to formalizing it, you've institutionalized it?
Yes.
Tried to weave it into the fabric of the agency, of
yes.
the operation?
And I will tell you, that's very reflective. About the same time that we started our mentoring program, the United States Army started a formal mentoring program. And so you'll see this throughout the Army.
You've talked about five initiatives in particular, and we touched on them before we went on the air. And I'd like to ask you about each of those. The first one is network modernization. Where are you right now on NetMod, and where do you want to go in the next year to 5 years?
So the Army Network Modernization Program was really defined by General Farrell, who is the CIO G6 in the United States Army, and his Army Network Campaign Plan. So it aligns the Army's network with the joint information environment that was defined by the DoD CIO. Really, what we're doing, and we're doing this in collaboration with DISA and in the Air Force, and the Navy will be joining us, is establishing a DoD-wide security architecture that allows us to really flatten the attack plane for the network. It's called the Joint Regional Security Stacks, and what we're doing is putting in place very robust security framework that will allow us to put the entire Army behind it. But it also allows us to collapse the number of security stacks we have organizationally. So within the Army, there are a number of different organizations, the Army Materiel Command, Corps of Engineers, Medical Command, et cetera, and they all have their own subnets inside of the network. What this will allow us to do is to eliminate those, have them all within the same security architecture. We're implementing an MPLS cloud with DISA, which will allow us to raise the bandwidth up to 100 gigs. And the goal is very simple, 100 gigs to every post, camp, and station, 10 to the building, 1 to the appliance. The intention is by inserting this technology, it allows us to put bandwidth off to the side for a while. It doesn't eliminate bandwidth as a constraint. I think everyone knows that if you raise it to 100 gigs, they will use 100 gigs.
That's right.
And I came from the intelligence community, and we were the demand side of bandwidth. And so I think it's ironic that now I'm on the supply side of bandwidth. But the idea is between MPLS and the regional security stacks, what it allows us to do is create a very robust network that then we will apply to each Army post, camp, and station and flatten those networks. And by flatten them, what we've done is redesign them with the latest technology, which will allow us to be able to operate, monitor, and defend the entire network from the appliance all the way back up to the internet access points. And so network modernization is the first piece of how cyber needs to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you'll hear the same from the commander of Cybercom, that these regional security stacks are very critical to get the DoD in a position where they can operate, maintain, and defend. So that's the first part. And where we are in that is, we're about a third of the way through with what we've done. We'll have all of the regional security stacks up and running by the end of the year, this year, for the United States and Europe. Southwest Asia will be just behind it. The Pacific will follow. The intention is by the end of 16, everyone will be behind the regional security stacks. This MPLS cloud will be in place in the United States by the end of the year. The first instantiation of Europe by the end of the calendar year, Pacific will come next year. So once we get the big highway laid and we have all the security posture in place, that also allows us then to bring in the tools, which leads to the next initiative, which is cyber, bring in the tools to actually execute cyber. We have the ability to do it today. But as we evolve the cyber concept of operations with regional cyber centers and the cyber protection team, my organization's responsible for the defensive cyber operations in the Army for the development, procurement, and then deployment of those capabilities. And we really kind of break that down into about four areas. There's one to build the infrastructure, so the defensive cyber operations infrastructure, which allows us to load the tools necessary for both the regional cyber centers and the cyber protection teams to defend the network. The second is to get those tools, additional tools for the cyber protection teams. We're putting tools in place to protect the internet-facing websites that are always a vulnerability. And then the last thing is big data. And we've got two pilots going on for big data to do both the collection analysis, how do we parse the data, and how do we analyze the data.
What can you tell me about those pilot programs? Everybody I know everywhere across government is talking about big data. How do we do it, and how do we do those three things that you just laid out there?
So you're right. I tell folks that when you talk about big data, it's the same as it was about 3 or 4 years ago, where everyone had a cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And you started to ask the question, well, what does it do? And so for us, big data analysis is really about, so big data analytics can be anything from analyzing the statistics of the New York Yankees. I'm a Yankees fan.
I'm sorry to hear that.
That's probably true. or you can use it to monitor your network to see if you can understand what's moving, what traffic is moving, why it's moving, and is that normal?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not normal, why isn't it normal? And so the tools for big data are to really look at a number of aspects of how information is flowing. Who's asking for the data? When are they asking for the data? Is that a normal process for them to look at the data? Or is the data moving in such large chunks that this doesn't make any sense? And so those are the kinds of tools that we're looking at. We're doing rapid deployment kits. All of this work is in collaboration with Cybercom and DISA, so that we don't, and with the Air Force and the Navy, so that we don't go off and develop 5 different sets of tools.
Mm-hmm.
We all look at the same data and come up with 5 different answers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really about the improving of the tools. And so the idea is to start with how is data moving? How do we ingest data? What are we looking for? And then as the operators start to become better and better at this, we will hone those requirements and change it. This is one that I expect product development is going to be very dynamic. Product development is going to be very quick because the threat is ever changing.
You mentioned cyber as one of your initiatives, but it strikes me as I look at the others that we talked about, not just in network modernization, which we've already covered, but we talked about business systems, biometrics, enterprise services. Cyber, I'm sure, is an important component of each of those in addition to being its own initiative that you're undertaking.
Oh, absolutely. So you'll hear my boss, Ms. Heidi Hsu, the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Acquisition, Logistics, and Technology, state that every program executive officer has a responsibility for cyber, mm-hmm. and they absolutely do. Every product that they deliver today, with the exception of maybe the pistol and the M4, has some level of IT in it.
Mm-hmm.
It has something in it that has to be monitored. It may have to be patched. And from a security aspect, how does it come onto the network? And then even if it doesn't come on the network, is it vulnerable to software being changed for it to operate in a way which is malicious compared to what we want it to do?
Mm-hmm.
And so you're right. We look at it from both, not just the ability to support or enable the cyber operations that are going on within DOD, but it's also each one of the program managers or project managers have a responsibility for cyber inside of their program.
So you're kind of managing your own proprietary Internet of Things with all of the things that you have on the network. I mean, when you think about all those different, if we think of all of those weapon systems and so on,
true,
as devices that are on the network, that sounds like that's kind of where you're headed.
You could consider it that, yes.
Yeah. Tell me about the business systems initiatives that you're undertaking. Those may not be quite as sexy as a big weapon system, but certainly as or more integral to the operation of the enterprise.
Oh, absolutely. So within my organization, business systems is really one of the big lines of effort. And we have all of the enterprise reporting planning systems, the big ERPs. But we also have other business systems within the organization. And what we're finding, especially in the ERPs, but really across every one of the products, is that we've gotten to a point where we're fielding. Some have been fielded, like the General Funds Enterprise Business System, GFIBS, has been fielded for a couple of years. And so the operators are using them and they're saying, you know, I know it can do all these things. I'd like it to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I believe we're really at a tipping point with some of these business systems. The Army's been very successful with the ERPs. We have the financial system fielded. We have the increment one of the logistics modernization program fielded. We have the increment one of the global combat support system Army fielded. So GCSS Army is the retail side of logistics. LMP is the wholesale, is the national level side of logistics. And so those programs are doing very, very well. We have the first increment of our integrated pay and personnel system fielded, which is the trusted database. They're doing very, very well. And what we're seeing is for those programs that are fielded, the users are looking, saying, can it do this? Can it do that? And so what we're developing are increment twos and increment threes for those programs to provide additional capability that wasn't in the original program.
And it sounds like you've developed them in such a way that you will be able to roll increment two and three in fairly quickly and in a kind of an agile environment. I don't know if it's formally agile development, but that it sounds like you're going at it with that worldview at least.
Every program will use agile development. We've used it in at least three of the ERPs in the last 3.5 years. Been very successful. It's been a very successful process that's gotten us a lot of speed. Mm-hmm. Is what it did. And so we will be doing it that way. Right now, we're in the requirements development process for the general funds program and for the retail side of the logistics, the Global Combat Support System Army program, the logistic program, the national level logistic program has an increment two, and they're starting to talk about an increment three, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. It's really about providing a capability the user wants and needs, and then they look and say, I'd like to add this and I'd like to add that. And so, and then within the Army, the proponent will go through a process to show why that's important. We do business case analysis to show that there's a return on investment, that this isn't just buying more, but it's buying more to save money someplace else. Mm-hmm. That's a very successful thing. It's really done very, very well.
And a couple of the components that you talked about there, I seem to recall reading, will be extremely useful, beneficial as the Army makes the push to meet the auditability deadlines that are coming up, the 2015-2017 deadlines.
Absolutely. The Logistics Modernization Program and the General Funds Enterprise Business System are the cornerstone for auditability, as well as GCSS Army. The Integrated Pay and Personnel System will be later, but it will be part of the 17-18 part of the audit. But yes, they are really the cornerstone to auditability.
The biometrics area is one that you're not unique in paying more attention to, certainly not even in just in the defense space. Civilian agencies are looking at that too. Where do you stand in biometrics right now, Doug?
So biometrics has been an extremely successful program, both in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was one of the key enablers to finding, identifying, and then catching some of the leadership that we really wanted to capture. Mm-hmm. Today, that's shifted a little bit, and so as we continue the war on terror, there are a lot of inquiries about biometrics that have been collected, and we have a database in West Virginia that does all of the matching of collections versus what's in the database for identity management, but also to help understand where someone has been and where it was collected. And the way the biometric system works, I should probably step back. The way it works is we have collection devices that are issued to the field. And in Afghanistan today, they will collect information in villages, at checkpoints, and they'll use the data for several reasons. One is to see if, as they come into a village, is someone that is new to the village, someone of interest that the coalition would like to talk to or capture. The other reason you use biometrics is for force protection. So as people try to get onto a forward operating base to look to be hired for a job, this will help us understand some of the history if there's been a collection before. Mm-hmm. And it actually has been very successful in people trying to get a job, and we find out that either they were involved in a military action or there's some connection to a military action or a criminal action. And so it has helped us try to do force protection for not only our troops but also the coalition troops in Afghanistan. What you will where I see it going is, so let me finish the story. So that's the collection devices. The collection devices have a small amount of memory where we load a watch list on it. But there's a massive database back in West Virginia for every collection that has ever been done. And what it allows us to do is it allows the intel community and the operational community to reach back and say, I've had a hit on Doug Wiltsey. Where else was Doug Wiltsey? And, mm-hmm. and they can provide a report that says he was in collections were taken in these four times and for these four reasons. And so it helps both the intelligence community and the operational community in understanding the environment and the people that are around them. The future of biometrics right now is under study. We have analysis of alternatives going on for the database. The collection device will follow. And the idea is, what capabilities do we believe we need in the future? What capabilities do we need to invest into now? And how much? And the reason I say that is this. So for the collection devices, they're an IT product. IT is always continuing to evolve. Packages are getting smaller and smaller with more robust computing power on it. How many devices do we need if we had to go into a new area of operation before we would turn to the market to say, what's the latest and greatest? And mm-hmm. so there's an analysis going on to set those conditions so that we can resource what's the future of the next generation of biometrics.
So it sounds to me like the progression that we'll see in biometrics will be maybe more linear than exponential, where we think about the next capability, and then once that capability is ascertained, the next one after that, rather than here are the 10 things that ideally it would be great to have at some point in the future, and we'll work toward one, and then we'll work toward the next two, and then the next four. Is that a fair read on my part?
It's a fair read, although it's a little premature. So the okay. So we can do it incrementally, which mm-hmm. is what you're describing. If we came out with six new features that we wanted in the collection devices, we probably would we would look at it to see what the cost is to do it as a single device, or is it something that we can do from an incremental standpoint. Mm-hmm. On the database, more than likely, because of the fiscal constraints, what I expect to come out is there'll be a priority list. We'll define how much priority number one costs, and then two, three, and four. And where that fits in the Army list of priorities determines whether we go after one of them, two of them, or all of them.
The last item on the initiative list that we discussed earlier is enterprise services. And that probably ranks up there with business systems in the unsexy department, but again, ranks up there as far as the level of import to the operation of the United States Army.
It is, and it brings, as you raise the network up to an enterprise level, with the bandwidth that we have, it allows us to now bring enterprise level services where before they were more local or organizationally defined. The enterprise services in the Army started with enterprise email. Mm-hmm. The next two that are big is going to be unified capabilities, which is really voice, video, presence, awareness, and chat, possibly email, possibly applications, possibly storage. But it would be an IT-based capability that would allow us to do a couple of things. One, it increases the level of collaboration in both Afghanistan and in Iraq. Merc chat was the predominant method for communicating. And so again, we have this generation of young men and women that chat all the time. using their smartphones. None of them doing it while driving, of course.
Of course.
But they're used to that, and so we need to bring that type of capability to them because they're familiar with it. And so it allows us to improve the level of collaboration, and it allows us to improve our capability. The third thing that it does is it allows us to retire legacy equipment. So if we can get voice and video over IP, it allows us to get rid of the old TDMA, the old ISDN lines that we continue to maintain today. So there's the enterprise services have improved operational capability, but they also have a cost savings on the back end of this, which is as important. When we deal with things in the network world or anything that we deal with the G6, he's really got three areas three tenets that we have to compare everything that we do to. And the first one is operational effectiveness. The second one is security. And the third one is efficiency. And so when you look like things like enterprise services, if we can bring all 1.4 million Army users to that capability, the prices for unified capability will be as cheap as they probably can get.
Mm-hmm.
Allows us to retire the old equipment, which is savings to the United States Army, and brings additional capability. So unified capabilities is a big focus. Enterprise collaboration is probably the second biggest one, and that's really the ability for us to collaborate not only across the Army, jointly and potentially with the coalition partners. That's from the operational commands in the Pacific, in Europe, and in Central Command. Interoperability, the ability to operate with their coalition partners, is absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a way, the development of these kinds of services is a way that we could evolve it to allow for coalition partners to be on the network.
When you talked about the opportunity to retire legacy systems, a question occurred to me that doesn't just apply to the concept of enterprise services, but to all of the areas that we talked about. And that's, I think, where we'll wind up today, Doug. And that is, how much of the equation, as you think about each of these, is each of those three things that we just talked about, efficiency and cost savings and effectiveness? I imagine they're not all equal, or they're not all the same in every case, but I wonder how you juggle those priorities as you think about which way to make decisions on some of these.
So if I came back to the five,
mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. Those three tenets we apply to everything we do. But if you come back to the five initiatives, so network modernization is really about operational effectiveness, then security. It's really about operational effectiveness and security are equal.
Mm-hmm.
Efficiency is close behind. On cyber, security becomes the number one thing, with operational effectiveness and then efficiency last. Within the business systems, what you'll find is operational effectiveness and efficiency will be very, very close. Security will be just a little bit below, with the understanding that in security in the applications world, it's a must-have.
Mm-hmm.
You can't trade security, but there's a level that you have to hit. You have to hit it, and it's really about how effective is the business system, how efficient is it? Because as those business systems expand with new increments, there are old legacy systems we're going to retire. We don't have to pay for them anymore. When you get to biometrics, it will be operational effectiveness, security, and then efficiency will be last.
I am very grateful for your time today. It's been a terrific opportunity to talk about the efforts that you're undertaking that are so critical for the operation of the Army. I'm grateful for your time, Doug. Thanks very much for coming today.
Thank you for having us here. Thank you.